Hi, I'm Armin Alney. Thanks so much for listening to The Point and Which Way L.A. You know, Elvis Mitchell has the inside scoop on all things pop culture. Every week, he hosts intimate conversations with creators and directors and actors and more about what makes them tick. And each week, I'm amazed at what I hear on The Treatment. You can find The Treatment on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Blacks, whites, and access to justice. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is an archived edition of To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After a grand jury failed to indict a policeman for shooting an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, people took to the streets in 170 other cities. Some said the case proved black lives don't matter in the United States, but polls show the nation is deeply divided on that issue. Do America's multiple justice systems provide equal treatment under the law? Or do they perpetuate the legacies of slavery and Jim Crow? Today's talking point, a re-examination of President Lyndon Johnson. Was he opposed to voting rights for all Americans? Or was it a question of timing? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, back with a repeat broadcast of To the Point. The mass of conflicting evidence released by prosecutors fed heated arguments about how and why Officer Darren Wilson killed Michael Brown last August in Ferguson, Missouri. That has sparked a broader debate about equal access to justice for black Americans. Today's talking point, President Lyndon Johnson is known for powerful persuasive skills, but he couldn't persuade Dr. Martin Luther King to wait for a Voting Rights Act. We'll talk with a presidential historian. First, this news update. 2.5 years ago, James Holmes walked into a crowded movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, during a midnight screening of Batman, The Dark Knight Rises. He opened fire, killing 12 people, wounding 50 others. Holmes admits he did the killings, but argues he was legally insane. The prosecutor wants the death penalty. Jury selection begins tomorrow. Jack Healy is Rocky Mountain correspondent for The New York Times. Hi, Jack. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Warren.
This has been a massive effort, I take it. Notices were mailed for jury service to 9,000 people?
By comparison, the trial of Jahar Tsarnaev over in Boston in the Marathon bombing case, there were about 1,300 or so prospective jurors, which I think just speaks to the scale of this case. They've sent out notices to approximately 1 in 50 eligible people in the suburban Denver County where the shooting took place. So obviously it's a massive net being cast by prosecutors and court officials as they try to assemble a jury.
People close to the prosecutor's office got notices, even people who were slated to be prosecution witnesses. Did any go to police officers?
Not that I know of directly. I think there were a couple of people who were related to police officers who, reported receiving these notices. Which really, it just speaks to the massive scale of this incident in the first place. I mean, it was an incident in an extremely crowded movie theater. There were, scores of witnesses, scores of emergency responders and law enforcement officers who came to the scene. Obviously, if you have, a crime that involves just that many people and you're sending out jury notices to that many people, I mean, the web of connections is going to be, potentially voluminous.
Well, now, the lawyers and Mr. Holmes' parents say that he's willing to plead guilty and spend the rest of his life in prison and not have a drawn-out trial. But the prosecutor is insisting on the death penalty. Is that the reason they're having the trial?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is the Republican district attorney, George Brockler, who is he's an elected official and has was the one who actually personally, made the call after consultations with, the victims to seek the death penalty in this case. He was actually in court, many, many months ago and, stood up in front of the judge and announced his intentions. And that's really what has set in motion this incredible complexity and also a lot of the delays. I mean, the shooting happened back in July of 2012, and there have just been, months of delays for various insanity investigations and, all sorts of other, legal delays that have really slowed the wheels of justice in this case.
Once the jury is picked, they'll have to decide if Holmes was sane or insane, and then whether, in fact, he is guilty. How long is that expected to take?
Months, multiple months. It will take perhaps until the spring or a little bit longer just to get through jury selection. As they go through these hundreds of names and people are struck for various reasons and the defense teams and prosecutors, examine the questionnaires that, hundreds upon hundreds of people fill out. That'll take a while. And then the amount of evidence that is expected to be displayed is just going to be just incredible. I think no one disputes that James Holmes committed this crime. But nevertheless, the prosecution, I think, is expected to, really put on a lot of evidence detailing what happened in that theater that night, from every angle and from the perspective of many, many witnesses. And then there's also going to be a lot of discussion of, what Mr. Holmes's life and mental state were like in the, months and days before the shooting.
Most often shootings like this end in suicide or in the police killing the person. You don't have a long trial. People don't have to live through it again. You've talked to a lot of people in the community, including some witnesses. How do they feel about it?
I think that there is a lot of different perspective based on your closeness to, to this trial and also your closeness to people who have, lost loved ones. I think some people are, not looking forward, obviously, but some people are looking towards some degree of resolution or some justice or some, legal accountability. Others are not looking forward to this at all. And, it's going to be a real media circus. It's going to last, weeks and weeks and weeks in which there will be, these constant recapitulations of this horrible, horrible crime scene. And I think that's going to be difficult for the community, as well as for people who were personally affected by this thing.
Okay. As you indicated, it's going to go on for a long time. There will be massive media coverage. No doubt we will hear about it again and again. Thanks so much for giving us a preview of what's going to happen. Jack Healy, once again, with the New York Times. Great to talk with you, and many thanks.
All right. Thanks so much.
In a moment, blacks, whites, and access to justice on To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. On this Martin Luther King Day, we are rebroadcasting a discussion that first aired on November 26th. At that time, protests had broken out in 170 cities over the non-indictment of Officer Darren Wilson for shooting the unarmed black teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Reaction to the grand jury decision exposed deep racial divisions over how the justice system works in this country. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder.
The reality is that what we see in Ferguson is not restricted to Ferguson. There are other communities around this country that have these same issues that have to be dealt with, and we at the Justice Department are determined to do all that we can to bridge those divides.
Others call for turning collective frustration into and anger into positive action designed to accomplish change. Jeffrey Stewart is professor and chair of the Black Studies Program at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What are these same issues that Attorney General Holder is talking about?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that the American justice system is broken, that it operates in different ways for different people, depending on whether you're a white or wealthy, or in certain parts of the country, different states and locales have different practices of investigation. We saw that obviously, when you had the attorney general for, in this case, essentially conduct what was in fact a kind of secret trial rather than actually a grand jury investigation as to whether to bring an indictment. Most people could tell that the fix was in from the beginning and that there was not going to be any indictment. And the conditions and principles upon which people are indicted for murdering people, particularly when the people who are victims are black, vary tremendously throughout the United States. But there is this constant sort of refrain, this constant sense that to kill a black person, especially a young black male, is consistently allowed by the Justice Department and the justice system in this country.
The prosecuting attorney released an enormous amount of evidence, including a lot of conflicting testimony by eyewitnesses and others as well. He says that that's a way of demonstrating that the fix was not in.
Yes. Well, I mean, that is one positive aspect of this, that he did release those documents, but I think the basic way in which he conducted his statement, I think, was largely seen as preposterous by legal experts around the nation, where he essentially attacked the eyewitnesses and essentially based the whole case on one eyewitness who witness number 10, who was approximately 100 yards away from the scene and who was the only one who confirmed Officer Wilson's argument that Brown charged at him. And in that case, he used the fact that there was conflicting eyewitness reports to invalidate all of them except the one that exonerated Officer Wilson. And many experts have said that in any case, you have conflicting eyewitness reports. And the job of the prosecutor is to work through those and find what is the most plausible witness accounts that exist. And in fact, he almost said that people lied. And afterwards, when he was questioned on this and said, well, if people lied under oath, should they be brought up on perjury? He said, oh, no, that's not necessary. Really invalidated his whole argument that this was a serious perjurious testimony.
The officer himself, Darren Wilson, did testify before the grand jury. That in itself was unusual, testified for about 4 hours, but he hadn't been heard from by the public until yesterday. Here's part of his conversation with George Stephanopoulos with ABC News.
Is there anything you could have done differently that would have prevented that killing from taking place?
No.
Nothing?
No.
And you're absolutely convinced, when you look through your heart and your mind, that if Michael Brown were white, this would have gone down in exactly the same way?
Yes.
No question.
No question.
Back to Jeffrey Stewart at the University of California, Santa Barbara. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, you have to admit that it's highly unusual to allow the person who is about to be charged in a case to testify without there being any cross-examination by the grand jury. In fact, that's the unique aspect of how this grand jury investigation went, is essentially it wasn't really just looking for if there's credible evidence. It was trying. And they allowed Wilson to testify without being cross-examined because his testimony has various problems with it. And that is the last issue there, is that there was nothing else he could have done. Here's a man who's 35 feet away from him, who already has four bullets in him, who obviously is in the process of already dying, who's stumbling around, and you squat down and put, you know, essentially 8 more bullets in him. I mean, this is an execution. This is not really a shooting. So it's obvious that, you know, in his police training, there were many other things that he could have done. He could have shot other areas. He could have shot once or twice. but he chose not to. And I think there's a deeper issue here. I think that in America right now, we're in a difficult place where vengeance is such an obsession, black and white, throughout our nation. And so you get the feeling that once he stopped these young men on the street, he supposedly said, you know, get off the effing street, get on the effing sidewalk. And then this young boy had the gumption to fight with him and to resist. He was going to make sure that he took him out to maintain his position as a white police officer. And I think that's throughout the testimony, throughout this whole thing, that there's a vengeance that he took out and took out on Michael Brown that most people can sort of, you know, see. I mean,
all right. Jeffrey Stewart, again, professor, chair of the Black Studies Program at the University of California in Santa Barbara. As you pointed out, these things look different in different places, in different locales, and in different communities. The Southern Baptist Convention was created in part in defense of slave owners. It is now America's largest Protestant organization. Russell Moore heads the convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. And Russell Moore, thank you very much for joining our program.
Very good to be with you.
You issued a long statement indicating that you think that it is time to deal with these issues on a national basis. What kind of reaction do you get from people, including people in your own congregations?
Well, mostly very positive because, of course, in our denomination, the fastest growing demographic is among African-American and Latino populations. And I think what people are beginning to see is that we're having two different conversations often whenever one of these situations arises. And unfortunately, we have had too many of them in recent years. And what happens is we often have white people looking only at the specific situation, and our African-American brothers and sisters in the church saying we have to look at the much bigger picture of what's happening in our lived experiences and in our lives. And one of the things that I notice is that the reason that these situations often resonate with African-American people in our churches who may be far distant from the situation itself is because they can immediately imagine their own sons or daughters or nieces or nephews being in these situations. And so I think the rest of the body of Christ, those of us who are Christians, we need to recognize that in order to have an informed conversation about these things.
But you have said that some of the emails and letters that you have received remind you of what you refer to as neo-Confederate rhetoric.
Yes.
Who do they come from, and what do they say?
Well, most of this is outside of the church, thankfully. I'm glad to say this is not coming from those who profess the name of Christ. But I think we do have in this country a great deal of racial hostility that often remains quite veiled. But people become very, for lack of a better word, they would see it as courageous when they get behind a computer screen and are able to fire off whatever is really in their hearts, which means that we have to get at this at a number of levels. One of those levels has to do with public justice. We have to work for public justice, but we can't stop there. We have to recognize that behind all of this, behind all of the divisions that we have in this country, there's a spiritual issue and a moral issue, and we have to address those issues as well.
What you are saying represents evolution over time on the part of the Southern Baptist Convention.
Well, not really. I mean, there were Southern Baptists leading the way during the Civil Rights Movement as well. Thankfully, shamefully, not enough. But the SBC voted to endorse Brown versus Board of Education and other things. But you're right. We were way too slow as a denomination to recognize what our own scriptures teach us, that every human being is created in the image of God, and that every human being bears the dignity of someone who is shaped and fashioned in the image of God. And even so, we still have a long way to go, not only in this country, but also in churches in this country. We really need to be in a place where we're not only talking with one another, but we're worshiping with one another and receiving one another as brothers and sisters, not just in the broadest sense, but in local congregations, in the same pews and around the same table. And I think that will get us a long way toward loving one another in this culture.
Russell Moore is with the Southern Baptist Convention. He joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. Brian Stevenson is executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. He's also author of Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. Brian Stevenson, welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
What is the Equal Justice Initiative?
We're a nonprofit that provides legal services to people, primarily the poor, the incarcerated, the condemned. We do a lot of work in the criminal justice system. And we also have a large project on race and poverty. We really want to change the narrative surrounding race in this country and the way in which we talk about race, the way in which we think about our history of racial inequality, because we think that's behind so many of the challenges that we see when we look at incidents like Ferguson.
Change the narrative. What about specific actions?
Well, I think the actions respond to the narrative. This country is rooted in racial inequality. We had decades of enslavement that we never really dealt with because slavery in America was different than slavery in other societies. It was rooted in an ideology of racial difference, that black people are more dangerous, more violent, less smart, less capable. That myth and ideology was never addressed at the end of the Civil War. We just stopped the forced labor part, and as a result of that, slavery didn't end. It evolved. It turned into 100 years of racial subordination, reinforced with violence and threats of violence as a mechanism for control. We lynched thousands of African Americans in this country, and we've never talked about what that lynching did to our thinking, to our narrative about racial difference. And then we had segregation and subordination, racial hierarchy, which we tolerated in the North and we perpetuated in the South. Refugees of that experience went to these communities across the country. And we've never committed ourselves to a process of truth and reconciliation. And so today, young people of color, African Americans in particular, are born with a presumption of guilt and dangerousness that follows them into communities, into department stores, on the streets, into airports, into schools. And that presumption is what is so extremely angering and frustrating and burdensome to people of color. And when you see it play out like it has in Ferguson, where a young man is killed, largely because he was presumed dangerous and guilty, then that failure to respond from the justice system just becomes one more reminder that this racial hierarchy still exists, that black life is devalued, and that we are burdened with this presumption of guilt and dangerousness that will not go away until the narrative about racial justice shifts.
Brian Stevenson again with the Equal Justice Initiative, also of Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. Quickly, before we need to go to our break, Jeffrey Stewart, back to you with the Black Studies Program at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Are there specific actions that are being proposed to the people who have been marching in 170 cities around the country?
Well, I think that I really resonate with what's been said by the other two guests, that this is a much more fundamental question than just what's going on in Ferguson. I also think that the economic dimension of this needs to be addressed, which is, you know, there is, according to many scholars and people like Carol Anderson, who's written a piece in the Washington Post about white rage, that there's a great deal of rage in the white community that is seeing itself essentially undermined economically, and there's an economic crisis going on in the society that is experienced differently, but nevertheless both by black and white. And so some people are beginning to say, you know, perhaps you need to think about some economic responses to these things, that perhaps the consumer culture, which is so driven by Thanksgiving, Black Friday, Christmas shopping, needs to be addressed. And then perhaps it's time for some kind of boycotts where people say, you know, we're not going to actually support system that essentially is making us angry and oppressed. So there have been people who have been voicing these possibilities as perhaps something moving beyond, evolving, as you said, beyond simply having protests, which I think in many cases were almost choreographed by the for people releasing the Ferguson decision in the middle of the evening, almost, you know, welcoming and encouraging people to act in violence.
All right. We're going to continue this conversation after we take our break. Later on today's Talking Point, a re-examination of President Lyndon Johnson. Did he oppose voting rights for all Americans, or was it a question of timing? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Anonley back with To The Point, talking today once again about the killing of Michael Brown, young black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, last August by the white policeman Darren Wilson. And it has just been suggested by Jeffrey Stewart at the Black Studies Program at the University of California, Santa Barbara, that perhaps economic retaliation is a good idea. I want to try that out on Brian Stevenson, again, executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. What about a Black Friday boycott, for example? Would that get them where it hurts?
Well, I think that, I'm not sure that that's the frame that's going to actually create our justice system to be better. I mean, I think, what bothers me, frankly, is the way we've been talking about this whole issue is organized around the spectacle of conflict, and I think underneath of that conflict, there is a larger problem, and we've got to talk about that larger problem. I think people are frustrated and angry, and they want to do things, but I think the things that we need to do is to hold people accountable. I mean, frankly, we've got people in power in our justice system that do not respond to the needs of poor and minority communities. We have a criminal justice system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. I think the focus of our activism has to be holding people accountable. The DA did a very poor job, in my judgment, and that person should be held accountable. I don't think that person is qualified to be the district attorney of all of the residents of Ferguson if they're going to demonize people of color, not respect the needs of people of color in that community, and conduct proceedings in the way that these proceedings were demonstrated.
How do you do that? How do you hold that man accountable?
Well, you demand that district attorney step down. You demand that the attorney general, if the attorney general will not intervene on behalf of residents of that part, you demand that they step down. In many communities where there are protests going on, district attorneys are elected. We actually have the capacity to vote in a way to get people who are more sensitive to the needs of the poor and people of color. And it shouldn't just be black people who are making these requests. That's the part of the coalition building that I think is so important. This is an American problem, and the problem won't be solved by only what black people do. We need people of goodwill and good conscience to see this as a tragedy, that we have a whole generation of children who have to be burdened with the threat of high rates of crime and violence and the threat of lethal interactions with police officers being suspected and menaced their whole lives is an American problem. And I think I resist this idea that this is something that the burden has got to be entirely on African Americans in this country to create a new paradigm for justice. They will say a lot, we will say a lot, but we all have a role to play in this.
Russell Moore, back to you, president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. You indicated that your largest growing congregation is coming from African Americans and Latinos. Is the largest Protestant organization in the United States in a position to demand the kind of accountability that Brian Stevenson just said is really what's necessary?
Well, we're not in a position to say in this particular case what ought to be done in terms of who ought to be in office and not be in office. I think we're addressing the broader root issue behind many of the conflicts that we have right now, and I think that's where we really need to have this conversation, is to say, why do we see a situation in which we have so much mistrust in this country, where people are reading these situations in completely different ways, and in which there is often a response that is carnal and evil, both in terms of a system that often demonizes African Americans, particularly young African American males, and then a counter response that often demonizes police officers as a whole, and sometimes erupts in the sort of violence that we saw that night in Ferguson. Most Americans don't want either of those things, I'm convinced. But we have to be able to understand what's happening and how that is taking place. And I think that comes down to a situation in which, in American culture, we have too low a view of human life and of human dignity, and we have to come back to that conversation that human beings are not here, and they don't exist simply in terms of their perceived usefulness to other people.
But even if you can't intervene in the situation in Ferguson, is it incumbent upon the church in other instances, as these kinds of incidents proliferate, which you seem to indicate that they have, is it incumbent on the church to try to do something about it and hold people accountable for injustice?
Yes, and I think the way that happens is manifold. One of those ways is forming consciences so that people recognize and understand that racial profiling, for instance, isn't just a social problem; it's a spiritual problem, and there's a more ultimate accountability to be had for violence, for injustice, than simply what happens in the here and now. That's one step of it. The other step of it is having people who are actively involved in, for instance, registering to vote and exercising citizenship. I mean, one of the things that we learned over the course of the 20th century and the civil rights movement is that voting registration and people who are actively involved, that makes a huge difference on politicians and those who are making these decisions.
You mentioned that police officers are often demonized as a whole. Let's go back to the situation in Ferguson and to the interview yesterday of Darren Wilson by George Stephanopoulos of ABC News. Here's an excerpt.
You say he starts to run, does a stutter step, starts to come toward you.
Mm-hmm.
And?
At that time, I gave myself another mental check. Can I shoot this guy? Legally, can I? And the question I answered myself was, I have to. If I don't, he will kill me if he gets to me.
Even though he's, 35, 40 feet away?
Once he's coming that direction, if he hasn't stopped yet, when's he going to stop?
Michael Raines is a criminal defense attorney who's represented officers accused of misconduct. One client was Johannes Messerly, a policeman in Oakland, California. He was accused of murder in the case of Oscar Grant, a young black man killed in a rapid transit station. Michael Raines, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
You were able to get that case one of manslaughter rather than a murder. But is there a case to be made, do you think, for Darren Wilson?
Oh, yes. I think without question, I think the event was precipitated at the car when Mr. Brown actually grabbed a hold of Officer Wilson's firearm, and his DNA evidence is on the firearm. A shot was fired there. And I think that precipitated the ensuing events, the foot chase, and then eventually, of course, Officer Wilson firing at Mr. Brown, who was then approaching him. The forensic evidence and the physical evidence shows that there were no shots to the back. The shots came in from the front as Mr. Brown was approaching Officer Wilson. So I think there is a case for the outcome that we've seen here, which is no indictment.
Okay. There is obviously a disagreement about the forensic evidence beyond what you have said about it. And there are those, I think someone on this program said, that in fact it didn't appear that Brown was charging toward the policeman, but rather that he was sort of grasping the air because he had already been shot. So there are different ways of looking at this. What's your take on the broader conversation that we've heard about the justice system and its failure again and again, refusal, if you will, to institute justice for young black people?
Well, I think this is reminiscent of what we saw in the Messerly case 5 years ago, and we had a great deal of dialogue there that is going on today. And I have to say, regrettably, I don't see any kind of a change in that dialogue today. There was anger, there was mistrust of the system then on the part of the African-American community and, frankly, on the part of the police. Here, we're hearing that the system is broken and should be indicted itself. And I have to say, here, looking at this from the outside, what should a prosecutor do in a case like this that has provoked the amount of controversy that this case did? What I saw here was, thank goodness, a sharing of information between the prosecutor and the United States government, the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice has had access to all of this information. They have shared their information with the prosecutor in this case. And also the public has now had access, unfettered access, to all of this information. I think there has been an attempt to share the evidence in this case with everybody so that everybody could make an informed judgment, including the Department of Justice. I think that's good. I think this process, while not perfect, has been a much better process for the airing of what occurred. You keep in mind that
we heard earlier on this program that the way that the evidence was presented to the grand jury without a cross-examination of the officer involved, for example, was evidence that actually, despite the fact that they released all this information, that the fix was in.
Well, that's what everybody says. And they talk about the lack of cross-examination, and, you know, I don't get it. You could say that about every one of the witnesses who testified there in front of this grand jury. They weren't cross-examined. Indeed, the purpose of cross-examination is to elicit additional information that the witness doesn't bring directly. In other words, to ask follow-up questions, to ask questions that probe the witness's memory and what they had to say. And it seems to me that people say there wasn't cross-examination. Perhaps what they mean is there wasn't the kind of rigorous, adversarial type of cross-examination that people want to see or see in TV. But here, follow-up questions were asked. Memories were probed of all witnesses, including Officer Wilson.
Okay, let me go back to Jeffrey Stewart again, chair of the Black Studies Program at the University of California, Santa Barbara. You were the one who said the fix was in. You brought up the issue of cross-examination. Michael Raine says that all we're seeing is the same thing over again that we heard in the Miserly case in Oakland some years ago.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, come on. I mean, look, this was a long, this is one of the longest grand jury investigations that you've seen in some time. I mean, it's pretty obvious that the whole point of it was to eventually avoid an indictment. I mean, yes, it's true that, you know, you don't have always cross-examination, but why wasn't it basically a quick determination of whether or not there was enough evidence to bring an indictment and then let it take place in a trial, which would have been a public forum? This was a secret kind of undertaking. Even though the documents have been released, the interpretation of those documents is important.
Okay, and so Michael Raines, what do you say to that?
Well, I say that the quick decision that is advocated here is exactly what happened in the Meserly case in Oakland, where the district attorney charged Meserly with murder in 10 days. It took him 10 days after the shooting to charge Meserly with murder. And that man's life was wrecked for 2 years until we finally got it to trial and a jury unanimously concluded in record time that there was no murder, there was no intent to kill, there was no intentional act whatsoever. Should a police officer
the officer involved is doing 2 years for involuntary manslaughter as a result of the trial.
The jury found that the officer committed an accident. He did not intend to kill anybody, and yet that was the sole charge that this officer faced for 2 years until we finally got the case.
So, Brian Stevenson, let me go back to you with the Equal Justice Initiative. What do you say to what we've heard from Michael Raines? Go ahead.
It's extremely frustrating. I mean, first of all, the officer in that case was convicted of a crime. It was criminal what he did to that young man at Fruitvale Station. And to deny a community that feels victimized and threatened the way African Americans do in all of these communities the opportunity to have people held accountable is the great injustice of Ferguson. You can't compare these two situations. I think people would have been, frankly, much more content with what happened if there had been an indictment and the officer was convicted of something. But that won't happen here. I also think these suggestions that cross-examination wasn't appropriate here are really misguided. You cross-examine to get the jurors, the lay people trying to evaluate things, to see the inconsistencies, to question whether what's being told to them is credible and reliable. That didn't happen here. And because that didn't happen here, there will be no opportunity to hold this officer accountable in state courts, which then makes the whole system a system that can be questioned. And I think what the gentleman from the Baptist Convention was saying is appropriate about holding people accountable, but I think we've got to demand this from our politicians, from our judges, our prosecutors. I think if the Southern Baptists said we want to end the politics of fear and anger that politicians and prosecutors and judges rely on to get votes, and if they stand against that and speak against that, we can have a very different conversation moving forward about these issues. And that's the challenge that I see we face. We've got to stop treating this as if somehow you're on one side or the other. There's a young man dead in the ground because a police officer shot him. There are very serious questions about whether that had to happen. I think the circumstances of this shooting make this a tremendous tragedy. And when we don't talk about it as a tragedy that needs a response, I think we just further the divide and don't get very far in trying to create just solutions.
All right. That's all the time we have for the moment. We'll, of course, be talking about this and related issues for a long time to come. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Again, Brian Stevenson is Executive Director of the Equal Justice Initiative. He's author of Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. Michael Raines is a defense attorney in Oakland, California, known for his defense of police officers, particularly in the case of Oscar Grant. Russell Moore is president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. That, of course, the largest Protestant organization in the country, the Southern Baptist Convention. And thanks to Jeffrey Stewart, professor and chair of the Black Studies Program at the University of California, Santa Barbara. The new movie Selma has focused attention on the obstacles faced by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and other activists as they tried to get a Voting Rights Act passed in Congress. Was one of those obstacles President Lyndon Johnson? We'll talk to a presidential historian about Johnson's legacy in a moment on To the Point.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Warren Olney back with today's Talking Point. The Great Society is an unprecedented package of legislation that protected the rights of African Americans and strengthened the social safety net. The bills were passed by Congress, but they are a major part of President Lyndon Johnson's legacy. Historians disagree, though, about the role he played and how he really felt about one component, the Voting Rights Act. Julian Sulitzer is a presidential scholar and history professor at Princeton University. His book, latest book, is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Julian Sulitzer, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Where did that phrase, the fierce urgency of now, come from?
That comes from Martin Luther King, and he used those words in his famous speech in Washington in August of 1963 when he stood by the Lincoln Memorial, and he was trying to urge both President Kennedy at the time and Congress to move forward on the Civil Rights Act, and he refused to wait any longer. And he said the civil rights movement was tired of gradualism, tired of being told to wait. And he reminded America, he said, of the fierce urgency of now to make real the promises of democracy.
Let's move forward a couple of years. President Kennedy has been shot. Lyndon Johnson has been reelected. He was vice president, of course, who became a president after Kennedy's death. Was he as reluctant to see a Voting Rights Act as portrayed in the movie Selma?
No, he wasn't. By early January of 1965, LBJ is firmly in support of voting rights. In fact, 1 month before the congressional session begins, he already had his attorney general start drafting a bill. Johnson is scared that proposing the bill too early in 1965 would cause political problems, that it could trigger some kind of a backlash in Congress, and he didn't want to move too fast. And he also wanted other items like Medicare and education to come first. So the real debate between him and Martin Luther King is over the timing of the bill. Johnson wants to wait a few months, and King, sensing the fierce urgency of now, wants the president to take this up very early.
Well, that's pretty much the way it's portrayed in the film, it seems to me, despite the criticism that's come even from some people who worked for Martin Luther King.
generally, but I do think what the movie doesn't convey is the true passion and commitment that Johnson had for this bill very early on. This was not a period where he's mostly concerned with surveillance on Martin Luther King, and he really wanted the bill to get through. I think sometimes the movie doesn't capture that. In Johnson's mind, Martin Luther King was going to be a partner, and they were going to try to create a congressional atmosphere that would be conducive to passing this.
You got the information, or some of the information that you have just reported, from some of the phone calls that were recorded. Is that right? You mentioned the Attorney General.
Yes, my book is based on a lot of these phone calls I listened to. I listened to almost all of them, as well as all the memoranda in the presidential library. The phone calls are very revealing. You can hear a lot of behind the scenes between Johnson and Congress. And that conversation with the Attorney General and another conversation with Martin Luther King in January are really phenomenal, because you can hear firsthand where all these different players were at the moment.
Do you hear Johnson being as persuasive as he is sometimes described as having been?
No, and part of what I'm trying to do with the book is to challenge that. He is persuasive, he's very skillful, but I think we've had a kind of myth of Lyndon Johnson that he could do anything he wanted. He could twist anyone's arm, he could seduce or bully anyone into doing anything. But really what mattered was you had this very vibrant civil rights movement creating immense pressure on Congress to act. And after 1964, Lyndon Johnson enjoyed huge liberal majorities in Capitol Hill for about 2 years, which were willing and able to pass almost anything that he wanted. So he was a very good politician, that's true, but we shouldn't overemphasize how much of Johnson himself was responsible for his success.
Speaking of those great Democratic majorities in Congress, one of the chapters of your book is called How Barry Goldwater Built the Great Society. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, we forget how important that 64 election was. Barry Goldwater, a conservative Republican, runs against Johnson. Johnson decimates him, and there's two effects. One is you have these large Democratic majorities that pass everything from Medicare to voting rights, and no Republican after 1964 wanted to be like Barry Goldwater. No one wanted to look too conservative. So in 1965, you have all these Republicans rushing to participate in drafting bills like Medicare so that they couldn't be tagged as extremists. And so Barry Goldwater running and running as a right-wing Republican was really important to the success of the Great Society.
So how important was Johnson's personality, his size and intimidating nature, do you think, to the success of his presidency? Not that it was completely successful.
It was important in that when the opportunities emerged, he was able to take advantage of them. But his personality and his skills don't account for the success he had. You have to understand the Congress that he had to work with. You had to understand the political environment that was going to allow a Lyndon Johnson to succeed. Obviously, his skills mattered, but we shouldn't give too much weight to that as the explanation for why you have really a watershed moment in American history in passing domestic programs.
You talk about the myths that have been perpetrated about him and about his power and the way that he exercised it. And you quote a White House aide for President Barack Obama saying, a few of us joked that we should just get Robert Caro's book on Lyndon Johnson, highlight a few pages and leave it on the president's desk. Do you think that Caro presents an accurate portrait of the president?
Well, he gives a very riveting and very shrewd analysis of the president. But Caro's focus is the president, understanding the president, understanding his strategy, and understanding his mentality. The other side of the equation is Capitol Hill, and the other side of the equation is the world within which Lyndon Johnson operates. I think in the end, you need to understand both, or the period doesn't make sense. And so when we say President Obama needs to be more like Lyndon Johnson, you know, we look back to some magic that the president had, which I don't think in the end will explain why that period was so bountiful in terms of domestic programs.
He certainly did, though, have a wealth of experience in the Congress as a congressman, as a senator for many years, and as majority leader. How important was that to him as a president?
That was very important. He was someone who literally grew up in Congress, and so he had a great feel for the institution. And most importantly, he more than anyone understood how powerful Congress was. He always used to tell people, Congress gets the best of every president. And he knew it would get the best of him eventually. So Johnson, because of that experience, he had great relationships on the Hill, but he also understood the limits of presidential power. So when the window opens in early 1965, he moves fast and he moves furiously because he knows better than anyone that that window is going to close. And, you know, he once said, power, the only power I've got is nuclear, and I can't even use that. And I think the experience on the Hill gave him that insight, and that's why he moved with such frenetic energy for that year and a half.
Did he, to some extent, do you think, miss being in the Congress?
I do think he missed being in the Congress, and after the 1966 midterms, conservatives regained power, and Lyndon Johnson, with all his magic, can't really do much anymore, and I don't think he enjoys the presidency very much as his coalition collapses, as Vietnam consumes all of the nation's attention, and as he can't get bills through. I think in some ways he loved Congress more than he loved the presidency.
So are you shooting down the idea that a president can come in to the White House without much experience with Congress and be very successful? Is it better to have a president who comes from Capitol Hill?
I do think it's better, and I also think it's good to have a Congress that's going to pass your bill. So when Barack Obama had that in his first year of office, he was very successful. And when the Republicans retook control of Congress in 2010, a lot of that faded away. So I think the lesson of the Great Society is that for those who want a Washington that's not broken, for those that want a Congress that is productive, they have to focus on how do you create the pressure on members in both parties to take action on all the big issues of the day. That's what happened in the mid-1960s, and that's when Lyndon Johnson stepped in. But if we ignore that, we're constantly searching for another, you know, legislative wizard who somehow is going to be able to make a very difficult system move forward.
Back to Martin Luther King Jr. and his role in the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Is that a lesson of a kind of how people who are not necessarily in positions of public power can and maybe must get involved in civic affairs?
Oh, absolutely. Martin Luther King, we think of as a great orator. We think of him as a community organizer, grassroots organizer. But the other thing he was a legislative strategist. And that came through very clearly as I was writing this. He always had an eye on Washington. And one of the things he did effectively was to coordinate what was going on the ground, what the protests were going to be, and what was going on back on Capitol Hill. So the marches in Selma were all targeting a very specific piece of legislation that he wanted to move forward, the Voting Rights Act, same the year before with civil rights. And King was very special that way, and I think he represents a model of grassroots organizing connected to Washington politics that is incredibly important to understanding the success of that moment.
Julian Zelitzer, a very appropriate conversation for Martin Luther King Day. The book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, which comes from King himself. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.